Americans and that our goal is peaceful, we agreed to the suspension. The suspensions were the first incident that hurt our nuclear program. The Westerners, not including the US at the time, tried to stop us, but 2 years later, we started our work again. They realized that they couldn't stop us, and then came the assassinations.
The April round of Vienna talks came just 3 days after a sabotage attack at the key Iranian nuclear plant near Natanz, an act of nuclear terrorism, as Iran put it. What happened was an explosion cut off electricity to the site, damaging an unknown number of centrifuges. Centrifuges are machines that make uranium usable for nuclear purposes. Mr. Obniki is former head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization's Development Center. He shared his views with Iran Today.
It is needless to say that the sanctions have been in place since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, when the Iranians decided to be independent and not to be despicably submissive to the West anymore. Since that day, they have been imposing different sanctions under different pretexts. And if we didn't have a nuclear program, they would definitely find another excuse to justify their mean sanctions. They want us to be entirely dependent so that we become completely obedient to them. They could not tolerate our missile program too, because they know it has strengthened our authority and defensive power.
The Vienna talks are to get the US to lift sanctions off this country, what it was supposed to do by the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal. But former US President Donald Trump binned that deal and reimposed and reinforced sanctions on this country, so Iran also started reversing its commitments to the deal. Now, what's the result of that and U.S. efforts, continuous U.S. efforts to weaken Iran's nuclear program and portray its politicians as weak in the eyes of the people? Iran mustered up its will and is now enriching uranium to 60%. That's up from what was under 4% to 20% and now 60%. Iran also attempted adding about 1,000 advanced centrifuges to its operation at Natanz. Looks like the U.S. missed again. Its greatest achievement from all its plotting and planning has been to alienate the Iranian people. It's not just the level of purity that matters, but the volume. Iran's 20% enriched uranium reserves now exceed 210 kilograms, and its 60% reserves amount to 25 kilograms. This country is also producing 150 types of deuterons, radiopharmacies used for diagnosing and treating various diseases, including cancer, and the best heavy water in the world. Also, we've made considerable progress in producing laser applicable in healthcare as well as industrial sectors. The April 2021 Natanz attack was not the first. Last summer came a destruction of a large assembly facility for advanced centrifuges. More recently, there was an assassination against a very prominent Iranian nuclear scientist, Fakhrizadeh. That was 27th November 2020. Also, years ago, under the Obama administration, the cyber attack Stuxnet did significant damage to centrifuges at Natanz. It is in a game similar to the American game that Iran has moved up to 60% uranium enrichment to strengthen its negotiating position in the Vienna talks, among other reasons.
The Americans and the Israelis had a plan to damage Iranian facilities by any means, one of which was the Stuxnet virus. They had put the virus in the equipment installed in our facilities, enabling them to infiltrate some of the computers that run the centrifuges. Needless to say, all centrifuges are run by computers, so the infected computers damaged some centrifuges. They thought that the trick would destroy Iran's nuclear industry, at least in Natanz, but they were wrong.
Between 2007 and 2012, several assassination attempts were made, leaving four nuclear scientists dead. Those were Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan. While another scientist, Fereydoun Abbasi, was wounded in an attempted murder in 2010 but survived.
They think that they can advance their agenda by assassinating people, which is partly true. After a scientist is assassinated, you'll need to wait for 30 years to have someone like him trained, if at all. This is a cause for concern. But on the other hand, This made people more resolute to continue their work with more rigor. Our distinctive attitude, which I call the spirit of self-sacrifice, has enabled us to do that. When such incidents take place, we'll become more courageous to try harder. This led to an increase in the number of young people who choose to study and start work in this field.
The one thing that curbed Iran's nuclear program was diplomacy and convention, meaning the 2015 JCPOA or nuclear deal signed between Iran and the P5 plus one countries, which include the US. But Iran's commitment to that deal was returned by US deal breaking. Talking of the importance of education to the livelihood of the nuclear program, universities are closely connected to nuclear research centers. In 1959, soon after the launch of the Iranian nuclear program, the Tehran Nuclear Research Center, TNRC, was established as part of Tehran University. And in 2007, the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, NSTRI, was established to meet the country's demand for the development of nuclear science and technologies. NSTRI is affiliated to Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. Examples for nuclear education and educational centers are many, but what's marvelous is 1,300 students switching majors to nuclear sciences in 2012 to fill in for an assassinated scientist, Ahmadi Roshan. More than 1,500 sanctions were imposed on Iran after Trump's USA withdrew from the nuclear deal or agreement, many of those sanctions being related to Iran's nuclear activities. It is now to be seen whether this country's nuclear upgrading by research and membership will serve as the deterrent and incentive intended to get those sanctions lifted with the November Vienna talks. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week for a follow-up or a totally different story. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
After killing dozens of Syrian civilians in a 2019 bombing, the U.S. military exonerated itself and concealed evidence. It's the latest scandal for a shadow U.S. war in Syria that has evaded oversight. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Aaron Mate titled, "Syria's My Lie, U.S. Massacred 70 Civilians and Covered It Up." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The New York Times has exposed one of the U.S. military's worst massacres and cover-up scandals since My Lai in Vietnam. On March 18, 2019, amid a so-called battle with the Daesh Takfiri terrorists, the U.S. Air Force bombed a crowd of civilians taking shelter near the town of Baghouz, Syria, killing a reported 70 people. The attacks occurred within a five-minute span, an initial strike and then another with heavier bombs as survivors fled. The Times' Dave Phillips and Eric Smith report, without warning, an American F-15E attack jet dropped a 500-pound bomb on the crowd, swallowing it in a shattering blast. As the smoke cleared, a few people stumbled away in search of cover. Then a jet tracking them dropped one 2,000-pound bomb, then another, killing most of the survivors. U.S. military personnel in Qatar watched the attack in real time via a surveillance drone at a scene. The high-definition footage showed that only two or three armed men were near the crowd and were not engaging in any kind of combat activity that would have justified a defensive military strike. Phillips and Schmidt write, instead of accountability at every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The site of the bombing was bulldozed. The unit that conducted the strike vindicated itself. Key evidence was buried, military logs were altered, and investigations were stalled and subverted. Although the Pentagon's independent inspector general managed to launch a probe, the report containing its findings was stalled and stripped of any mention of the strike. Called in by a classified Special Operations Unit Task Force 9, which led U.S. ground operations in Syria. 2 months after the March 2019 massacre, the task force completed a civilian casualty report on the strike that claimed that only four civilians were killed. It also determined that the strike was lawfully conducted in self-defense. The Baghouz killings likely only came to light because of whistleblowers who challenged the cover-up from within. Lieutenant General Dean W. Corsack, an Air Force lawyer present in Qatar Air Base, when the massacre was observed, immediately ordered officials to preserve evidence, including video, and urged superiors to open a war crimes investigation. When they refused, Corsack alerted the Pentagon's independent inspector general. Earlier this year, after 2 years of inaction, Corsack shared details about the cover-up with the Senate Armed Services Committee. He wrote, "I'm putting myself at great risk of military retaliation for sending this," adding, "senior-ranking U.S. military officials intentionally and systematically circumvented the deliberate strike process." Corsack wrote that a unit had intentionally entered false strike log entities, clearly seeking to cover up the incidents. Calling the classified death toll shockingly high, he said the military did not follow its own requirements to report and investigate the strike. He wrote there was a good chance that the highest levels of government remained unaware of what was happening on the ground. When Corsack alerted the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations, an Air Force major replied that the office would likely only probe the massacre if there was a potential for high media attention, concerned with outcry from local community and government, concerned sensitive images may get out. Committee reached out to Corsack after being approached by another whistleblower, Gene Tate, an investigator at the Pentagon's Inspector General Office. Tate told the Times that he witnessed similar stonewalling and censorship. Tate said leadership just seemed to set on bearing this. No one wanted anything to do with it, adding, "It makes you lose faith in the system when people are trying to do what's right, but no one in positions of leadership wants to hear it." After raising concerns at multiple levels, Tate says that in October 2020, he was forced out of his position and escorted from the building by security. In response to the New York Times, Central Command acknowledged the Baghouz massacre for the first time, but it continues to deny the civilian toll, insisting that just 4 civilians were killed. According to the Times, a U.S. military statement claimed that 60 of the dead may have not been civilians. The Times uncovered additional evidence that the cover-up is part of a broader pattern of U.S. terrorist forces ignoring safeguards against attacking civilians in Syria and hiding the death toll. According to the Times, some officials believe that Task Force 9, the unit behind the strike, was systematically circumventing the safeguards created to limit civilian deaths. By late 2018, about 80% of all airstrikes it was calling in claimed self-defense. Previous mass casualty-causing military operations in Syria have also evaded scrutiny. As a New Yorker report observed in 2020, U.S. bombings in Syria have reduced parts of the country to wasteland. In Raqqa, U.S. adopted the strategy of physical annihilation applied against a city that still harbored a significant civilian population, causing an utter decimation that might be unique in this century. According to the Times expose on Baghouz, U.S. officials assessing civilian deaths in places like Raqqa did not investigate on the ground and often based their findings on how many dead civilians they could definitively identify from aerial footage of the rubble. News of the massacre comes just days after the U.S. military exonerated itself for the killing of 10 civilians, including 7 children, in its August drone strike in Kabul. The U.S. military's cover-up of the Baghouz massacre also parallels the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. A reported 504 Vietnamese civilians, including 182 women and 173 children, were slaughtered by U.S. occupation forces in My Lai, a neighboring My Khe 4, on March 16, 1968. Just like in Baghouz, the U.S. military unit involved in My Lai massacre, the 11th Infantry Brigade, carried out an investigation and exonerated itself. The atrocity was revealed in November 1969 by journalist Seymour Hersh, who interviewed two of the key perpetrators. Hersh's report, published by the small anti-war outlet The Dispatch News Service, helped turn U.S. public opinion against the Vietnam War. The massacre was kept hidden from the public for a year longer than My Lai was. Hersh's story came out 18 months after the My Lai massacre. The Baghouz slaughter occurred on March 18, 2019 and was revealed by the New York Times on November 13, 2021, more than 2 years later. Coincidentally, the Times story was published one day after the 52nd anniversary of Hersh's report on My Lai on November 12, 1969. The lack of accountability for U.S. bombings that kill civilians is only one element of a years-long U.S. warfare campaign in Syria, given a blank check by Congress and kept largely from public view. Against the will of the Syrian government and with no authorization from the United Nations Security Council or the U.S. Congress, the U.S. military continues to occupy a large swath of northeast Syria with hundreds of troops. The Biden administration has deceived the public about both the nature of the U.S. mission in Syria and its motives. Although the U.S. claims that its sole purpose in Syria is fighting Daesh, the U.S. military has in fact rarely done any fighting over the last 2 years. In 2019, now senior Biden official Donna Stroll admitted that the U.S. military occupation in Syria is not only about completing the anti-Daesh fight, Strahl explained, in reality, occupying the resource-rich economic powerhouse region in Syria's northeast, which contains the country's hydrocarbons and is its agricultural powerhouse, gives the U.S. government broader leverage to influence a political outcome in Syria in line with U.S. dictates.
Uyghur people. The U.S. is still maintaining its broken immigration policy, even during the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden. In the previous administration, the left-wing leaning media kept criticizing President Donald Trump for his crackdown on so-called illegal aliens, keeping children in cages, families separated, and trying to build a wall on the border with Mexico. And while the government is now safely distant from that media hype, not much has changed. Apprehending and removing undocumented immigrants who are considered a threat to national security and public safety of the U.S. continues unabated in a country claiming to be leader of the free world.
Immigration under Biden.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll try to search for any end in sight on the issue of immigration, its victims and its enforcers, and broken policies creating the stalemate we are witnessing nowadays. My first guest in this episode will be journalist and author Daniel Lazar, and later on the show, I'll be joined by activist and commentator Don DeBar. Please stay with us as we delve into the ups and downs of the issue and do our best to shed light on how the situation could pan out for immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in America.
Immigration has always been essential to America. Let's end our exhausting war over immigration. For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it. On day one of my presidency, I kept my commitment and sent a comprehensive immigration bill to the United States Congress. If you believe we need to secure the border, pass it because it has a lot of money for high-tech border security. If you believe in a pathway to citizenship, pass it. Over 11 million undocumented folks, the vast majority of here overstaying visas, pass it. We can actually, if you actually want to solve a problem, I've sent a bill to take a close look at it.
Now, previously, we asked Mr. Lazar what he thinks the fact that migrants and refugee seekers' deaths at the U.S. southern border with Mexico has reached an all-time high. What exactly does that mean for Washington's continued claims of promoting human rights throughout the world?
Well, it certainly undercuts any U.S. claims to be enforcing human rights. The U.S. is pursuing extremely unjust policies with regard to immigration and internal economic development in the countries that are hardest hit in the Caribbean and in Central America, and the U.S. to a great extent is actually causing these problems that it now is wrestling with.
The U.S. southern border continues to be the epicenter of crackdown on asylum seekers and refugees. But their plight extends further into the country, where they continue to face harassment and fears of deportation. Even those who have been on U.S. soil for generations and contributed to the country's well-being are not exempt from suffering.
There is no easy solution to migration because it's the interaction of different vulnerabilities, the violence, the lack of opportunities, you know, the the vulnerability to natural disasters.
The Biden administration has not offered any practical shift in the U.S. anti-immigration policies and basically continues pushing the same policies regardless of the Democrats' full control over the country.
Earlier, we asked our guest Don DeBar that given the profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how he thinks the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants is going to pan out.
The first thing is, you know, what's broken and what's fixed and how is it supposed to function? Essentially, the immigration into the United States and into the European Union, you know, also I assume into places like Japan and South Korea and Australia, places where there aren't wars being conducted right now and or death squads chasing people around, that those are magnets for people that are suffering the results of imperialism and U.S. foreign policy. People are being driven out of their homes because the conditions in their countries are intolerable as a direct consequence of colonial relations economically, imperial relations politically, and pretty much fascistic policies by the comprador governments that are placed in power by the U.S. and European colonial powers.
So hypocrisy prevails in U.S. politics as before, and the issue of immigration is no exception. Migrants keep being subjected to inhumane tactics such as Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico program. Now, Joe Biden had vowed to compensate families of children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border throughout the Trump administration, a pledge which remains to be materialized to this very day.
In balance, I would say that Trump's policies were maybe slightly worse, but the difference is really insignificant, and Biden has essentially pursued much the same policies. The problem is that the U.S. has devastated the Haitian economy. It has supported a coup d'etat. It has encouraged the growth of drug gangs due to its highly punitive approach to the war on drugs. And at the same time, it forbids Haitians to immigrate. Now, the U.S. has pursued some of the same policies in Puerto Rico, which is also located in the Caribbean.
The Democratic president also keeps pursuing the Trump policy known as Title 42, which continues to return migrants to an uncertain future in Mexico. Officially called the Migrant Protection Protocols, the program has so far sent over 70,000 people to unsafe cities near the U.S. border in Mexico. Given profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how is the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants going to pan out?
Biden sent 7,000 of them back to Haiti, where they originated. But Haiti is a devastated country where crime is through the roof. Criminal gangs control the countryside. And in fact, it's so bad that American diplomats are forbidden to leave the embassy grounds because doing so is simply too dangerous. So that actually surpasses anything that Trump did. It was a major crime against humanity.
Title 42 expulsions are just the tip of the iceberg in the U.S. crackdown on immigrants. In his first 6 months in office, Biden has exceedingly used that authority and even broken Trump's record in the quest to suppress immigrants at the southern border. The U.S. government boasted about payments of around $450,000 to compensate the brutal family separation practice. But now it has not only changed that figure, but also cast aspersions on whether it would be paid at all.
Now, the crisis at the border is a telltale of the human rights situation in America. Putting kids in cages or so-called migrant facilities represents the depth of U.S. politicians' disregard for children who actually never chose to enter the country on their own. And the Trump administration was notorious for exercising zero tolerance at the U.S. border with Mexico. So what is the difference between the Trump administration and the current one in terms of dealing with migration at the southern border?
But primarily the media coverage. People are being sent back. You know, Obama was the great deporter. He actually sent back more people than Trump did by, I think, a factor of two or three, I forget. Not just because of his 8 years to 4 years, but actually in terms of, you know, per year, he sent more people back than Trump did. And Trump's numbers went down after securing the border in the first group under his administration, as opposed to the way it had been secured under Obama or Bush or Clinton.
The story of immigration into the United States has been laced with continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse.
The situation facing people that leave a precarious situation in the Caribbean and Latin American countries are going to come to the United States and find also a precarious situation for themselves, with the exception of the compradors, the people that moved to Cuba, for example, after the Cuban Revolution, or the people that moved to Miami from Cuba, and the people that moved to Miami from Venezuela after 1998, the people that moved to Miami from Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those people do very well when they get here, or some of them do.
Now, whether or not they get in, most end up disillusioned at the conclusion of their journey. Life is certainly not pleasant for a large number of immigrants, no matter whether they enter the country legally or illegally, or those falling victim to gangs and cartels on the way. What do you personally think is next in the fight for immigrants' rights, and where do you see the U.S. government heading in dealing with this issue?
If there was some way to organically connect working people in the world, communicate directly with each other, and someone asked me this question knowing that, you know, it might be an input into the policy of people around the world, I would say first thing that has to happen is that workers in every place, whether they're in the United States or in Honduras or in Haiti or in Africa or in Belgium, have an interest that is distinct from that of the elite. None of us have an interest that identifies with the elite. And so where we find ourselves ignoring what the elite is doing to people in of the places I just mentioned, then we are already going to lose.
Republican politicians keep linking immigration into America to rising crime rates in the country. In fact, speaking about the issue, which is often laced with racism, is a talking point for the GOP officials to score political points ahead of the 2022 midterms and the 2024 presidential election. This is while U.S. imperialist policies have been touted as the main cause for Central American struggle for decades, which has led to influx of migrants at the border.
Their claim by one party over another to be concerned about the deaths of migrants and to be concerned about the lives of migrants, the lie is given to it by these statistics. These numbers have been pretty much constant, you know, within certain fractions on one side or the other, no matter if it were George Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump as president, regardless of all the rhetoric that goes around the issue.
Now, the federal government and states such as Texas are meanwhile locked in fierce battles over the number of arrivals at the U.S.-Mexico border, by which southern states are immediately affected. How do you think the more progressive factions of the Democratic Party should react to the Biden administration's deportation of Haitians?
They should react not only by opposing deportations, but demanding comprehensive reform of U.S. economic policies, military policies, drug war policies, etc., in the Caribbean and in Central America. But they are not going to do that. They're just way too weak and way too narrowly focused to do anything like that. But that's what's needed, though.
Biden created a task force after taking office to address some of the brutal policies of the former presidents. Yet a whole lot of the pledges are still blowing in the wind. Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy may have officially ended, but not much hope is in sight for families of migrants as the more sophisticated anti-immigration practices persist. Crossing the border illegally, meanwhile, remains the final solution for people escaping violence, poverty, and insecurity in certain countries of Central and Southern America.
Biden's policies are very bad. Biden represents a continuation of the policies of the last half century, which have had a devastating effect on the Caribbean, on Central America, et cetera. Not only has the U.S. supported dictators and coups, et cetera, but the U.S. economic policies have also had a devastating consequence. For example, Haitian agriculture has been destroyed by cheap U.S. imports, and Haiti essentially is not allowed to impose any kind of import restrictions due to intense pressure from U.S.-controlled agencies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Hoping to reach a land where so-called human rights are promoted on a daily basis, refugees are confronted with an iron fist. So where do you think the American public stands about the Biden administration's handling of migration, given the fact that the nation was built by slaves and migrants in the first place?
Upon a genocide. First, they had to clear the land of the people who lived here. And then they had immigrants come. Some were induced or enticed into coming in one way or another, and others were just captured and dragged over here in chains. There's no question about the moral basis of opposition to immigration being, bad. There's no moral basis for it. Certainly no moral basis for anyone in the United States outside of the people who are indigenous to this continent. It's a more complex problem than just saying, this group is right for saying immigrants should have free, access in and out of the country, and this group is wrong for saying that they shouldn't, because what in fact has happened is that you've had an attack on the people outside of the country in various nations. Again, Central and South America we're talking about here, primarily in the Caribbean, but this has been going on in Africa and Asia as well. And
the issue of immigration, like many other issues, has been extremely politicized. Trump once said that he proudly gave secure borders to Biden despite the current situation. He even suggested that he created a smooth running system on autopilot at the border, which Biden has now broken.
Well, I see the U.S. government heading towards more and more repressive measures and doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to reform its economic, military, and drug war policies in the Caribbean and Central America. I see absolutely nothing happening there. I only see a worsening, in fact. And so, therefore, that means there will be more human suffering, more desperate people on the Texas border fighting to get in, more kids abandoned, just more human horror stories.
Trump's anti-immigration policy was a centerpiece of his 2016 election campaign and is now a major issue as he seeks re-election in 2024. On the other hand, the current presidents appear to have been designed to keep both camps happy. But what about the rights of actual humans amassing at the border? No one really seems to care.
From now on, we have a new segment in our program titled Power to the People, by Abbas Montarem, first part.
Peace, what's going on? My name is Abbas Montarem, and I'm super excited to introduce this new segment of the show called Power to the People. On Power to the People, we're going to be examining the racism that is ingrained throughout this country, right? And if we want to fully understand racism, we have to understand the vehicle that racism has been driven through is settler colonialism, right? So on this episode, we're going to get a full understanding as best as we can in the next few minutes of what settler colonialism is as an ideology, as a practice, as a colonial practice of domination, subjugation, that enacts genocide against indigenous peoples as well as African peoples, right? So the foundation of this country is a settler colony, meaning a foreign people, right? A foreign people from the land, people that the land has no right to, came. In this case, the Europeans came from all over Europe, came to America, enacted genocide on the indigenous people, stole their land, brought with them diseases, rape, pillage, some of the most inhumane crimes against humanity is what the Europeans did to America, right? This is why we call them Euro-Americans, because they are Europeans who came and created America, which has no legal or human right to exist based off of genocide, right? Because this is what it is. It's a genocidal country that was founded through the most terroristic acts against humanity. Through settler colonialism, the Europeans stole the land from the indigenous people, and also they stole Africans, they stole us, they stole our people, right? They stole our people from the continent, our ancestral homeland, and forced us to come to the South. Forced us as slaves to come to the South. And it's very important to note that African peoples, we have been resisting ever since the first European came to the continent. Ever since the first European came to the continent, we have resisted the genocidal conditions that the Europeans have tried to bring to our continent and to ourselves as people, right? But we were enslaved in the South through settler colonialism. They brought us as people, as a colony, as a nation of people, as different nations of people, to a colony in the South, and there we have the plantation. So if we want to understand the foundation of American capitalism, if we want to understand the foundation of American settler colonialism, if we want to understand the foundation of American racism, it goes back to settler colonialism and the slave trade and slavery, right? Through slavery, America has become the biggest purveyor of violence. They not only enacted violence on the plantation, but they subjugated us to the economic rule of that, right? Which, what does that mean? That means that our bodies was the biggest amount of capital. Our bodies, before the so-called dollar even existed, our bodies is what existed as capital, right? So the value of slaves was roughly 3 times greater than the total amount invested in banks, and it was equal to about 7 times the total values of all currency in circulation in the country. 3 times the value of the entire livestock population, 12 times the value of the entire U.S. cotton crop, right? And 48 times the total expenditure of the federal government that year. Our bodies. People talk about the New York Stock Exchange. We were the first people traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Not stock, we were the stock. Our bodies was a stock. Our people was a stock. Our languages was a stock. Forcing us to do the labor of this country, to expand this country, right? To expand it to what we know as the so-called 50 United States of America. Banks such as Wells Fargo own slaves. Own slaves as collateral. The foundation of this banking system in America goes back to the enslavement of our people, where these lazy Europeans didn't work and forced us to work through subjugation of the most crimes. These are some of the biggest crimes against humanity, and it must be understood as such. This is the foundation of the economy, and we must understand that the foundation of this economy was our lives, where cotton was the leading American export from 1803 to 1937. What we were forced to pick, cotton, the leading American export. What does that mean? Now this country is getting rich, is getting wealthy, developing the wealth to then now have more advanced weapons because they enslaved us. They exterminated, they made attempts to exterminate the indigenous people, and they forced Africans through slavery to produce the economics of this country. All this wealth now is used to fund imperialism and to strengthen the military. So if we understand settler colonialism in America, we understand that also Israel, the regime of Israel, has no right to exist. The regime of Israel has no right to exist. It in itself is another settler colony, right? That's why when we connect these dots between what's going on here in America and what's going on in the illegal Zionist Israeli occupation, we see that the Americans, right, the Euro-Americans, the colonizers, the slave owners, right, they're the ones helping fund the Iron Dome. This is by no mistake, right? So we connect these issues with the issues of freeing Palestine to freeing the land here from Euro-American control. So my name is Abbas Muntakeem. Hopefully y'all got a better understanding of what settler colonialism is. In the next episode, we're going to talk some more. So this is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Muntakeem. tap into the next episode.
Thank you, Abbas, and thank you, viewers, for watching the program. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure you tune in next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Thanks for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Muslims' duty towards the all-inclusiveness of Islam, promoting Islam's viewpoint.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Well, Islamic texts explicitly reject this, and we Muslims should pay attention to this matter. When I say that we should do our duty, I primarily mean that we should promote and express the view of Islam about itself and about the areas of human life it cares about, it gives an opinion about, it works on, it explains, it promotes, and it expresses. This is the first step. Then we should try to put these into practice. What Islam states is that the field of activity of this religion is the entire scope of human life, ranging from human emotions to social, political, and international issues, and including issues related to all of humanity. This has been clearly explained in the Holy Quran. If someone denies this, they have not paid attention to the words of the Quran.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is a verse in the Quran that says, O you who believe, celebrate the praise of Allah, and do this often, and glorify Him morning and evening. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verses 41 and 42. This is an issue related to one's beliefs and emotions. But there is another verse that states, those who believe fight in the cause of Allah, and those who reject faith fight in the cause of evil. So fight against the friends of Satan. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 76. This is another verse. So, celebrate the praise of Allah, and fight against the friends of Satan mean that this entire vast scope is covered by the deen. One verse addresses the Holy Prophet saying, "Stand to prayer by night, but not all night. Half of it, or a little less, or a little more, and recite the Qur'an in slow, measured, rhythmic tones." The Holy Qur'an, Surah 73, verses 2 to 4.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Yellow Vests have marked their third anniversary, going from a ragtag group of gas tax protesters into a political force which has overturned decades of Western political norms. The defining image of the Emmanuel Macron era is undoubtedly the graffiti on the Arc de Triomphe, which read, "The Yellow Vests will triumph." That shocked the world, and then so did the once-in-a-century political repression which gutted France's claim of being a leader in free speech and political freedom. The numbers were staggering. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 political prisoners, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. The Yellow Vests continue to redefine what citizen democracy is in the digital era by refusing to collude with the traditional hierarchies found in Western liberal democracies.
What we have done is provide a sort of national therapy. We made everybody, from politicians to unions to our institutions, fully aware of what a catastrophic situation France is in for the average person. 3 years ago, we took to the streets to demand economic justice, democratic justice, and ecological justice, and our movement has just begun.
Many ask what happened to the Yellow Vests, and the primary answer is that the massive state-sponsored violence and judicial intimidation, like the so-called anti-Yellow Vest law, scared the average person away from protesting. From June 2019 onwards, there seemed to be a blackout in French media on the Yellow Vests, as well as a massive censorship campaign on social media. After a year and a half pause due to the coronavirus, the Yellow Vests have marched every Saturday for over a month. They are expected to play a major role in France's presidential election in April. The Yellow Vests have proven themselves to be a new and entirely different type of political force. One which insists on inserting themselves into the political discourse, no matter how much some may try to ignore, silence, or repress. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Saint-Pierre has always been one of the busiest hospitals in Brussels, but now it is busier than ever. In the 24 hours up to Wednesday, more than 12,000 new cases of coronavirus were recorded in Belgium and 41 deaths. Even at the doors of Saint-Pierre, it's easy to find people who are vaccine hesitant.
I feel concerned for my part, but I know people from my age feel concerned but aren't really good with the idea of getting vaccinated.
I don't need the vaccine because it's 2 years there is the coronavirus, but I'm good. I'm very good. I'm not sick. And my family is not sick.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging across the EU. In Italy, workers cannot physically attend to their jobs without a COVID pass. Experts suggest the country is doing better than neighbours because more children there have received the jab. In Austria, the unvaccinated have effectively been put into lockdown. Most venues in the Netherlands must close by 8 p.m. Hospitals in Ireland, Czech Republic, Bulgaria and Romania are struggling to cope.
So the message remains clear. Get vaccinated, maintain masks and social distance. Vaccination is necessary in our fight against this virus.
A fifth wave of the virus is hitting France, Germany and Belgium. Health experts say there is still a lot about the crisis that is not understood. For example, it is not known why the vaccines do not work on 10% of people who take them. It is not clearly known for how long the vaccines remain effective. What is known, however, is that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to end up in hospital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid El-Fesfous, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. El-Fesfous is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says El-Fesfous could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelay Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if El-Fesfous or other hunger-striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope El-Fesfous won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Kaid El-Fesfous, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follow the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid El-Fesfous and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, El-Fesfous' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Fatah factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency. regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the